estate services, Lavazzi and Boob1.co.uk present the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who Podcast, or should I say the 20 Megabyte Wind Up to Kirby as Much as You Can Podcast, episode 476. I'm Adam, and I love you. I'll never stop loving you. There we go. I nearly cocked that up. I'm Adam, and I'll never stop loving you. And here's Matthew Kressel.
We play the contest again, Time Lord.
Oh, God. And she's back. It's Deborah Melrose.
Yay.
Leave all this silverware lying around. You're wide open.
Kirby Bartlett Sloan.
The problem is, it's not raining. There's a west wind.
And the delectable. Nearly got it out. The delectable. Mary Lang.
There's a wind whipping up.
Yes,
I can feel it through my clothes.
I can feel it from my clothes, funny enough, Mary. But I was trying to... I was trying to stifle it. No, Robert, this week, because Robert's going to get some rest. I think he deserves the rest he's getting. And we got Debbie with a dicky ticker to replace Robert this week. So all interchangeable presenters here on the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast.
We share duties.
Okay, are you sure you're not the same person and you just keep...
I'm still convinced that, yeah, there's something weird going on there.
So don't haven't you with your dicky ticker? Makes me want to watch Allo Allo again.
My dicky ticker.
Do a sound bite. Oh, my dicky ticker. Was it Kenneth? Was it Kenneth Connor?
Kenneth
wasn't
Moore,
it?
Wasn't it?
Pardon?
Name not Kenneth Moore. No.
Kenneth Connor.
Kenneth Connor. When he was the old funeral director.
Yes. Yes. Of Carry On film fame.
Yes. Kenneth Moore. Honestly.
I think he was in a Carry On film, Kenneth Moore, actually, but I may be wrong. So this week...
Distinguished ones.
Yes. So this week, it's The Curse of Fenric.
Yay!
I'm sure Kirsty will be joining us shortly. But we will begin, because we're here. Oh, yeah, but we have had some words coming through on the feed, but not on the one I'm viewing. What's going on here? It's funny. I had something came up and it disappeared. Oh. Right, stupid Facebook again. Right, so I'm going to have to open up another third page to monitor the slightly delayed or even more delayed feed so I can actually see what people are saying.
I've got it up on my phone if you would like me to read it, Adam.
Yeah, that's what she said.
We can see the comments.
Yeah, all right. I'd like to see them as well. Where am I looking? Oh, yes, the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who Podcast Facebook group, which you can join.
Right.
Hang on, still loading. Oh, here we are. Right, let's move it on. Yeah. Oh, I can see him now. Lillian Robbins says, hi. Tim, he's trying to get me to remind me to get my priority jingles folder over. Over? Open, indeed.
Over.
I'm tired. I had a very long day at work today. Jingles effect. That's not it. Priority jingles. PPP. ABC, there it is, priority jingles, and Tim Drury's here, so here we go. I do wish it would play it properly.
Drury's mention.
Yes, Tim Drury says, Curse of Fenric, one of the best of series 26, and Christian Basil says, hello team from the Legend of the Travelling TARDIS team, very good, plug, shall we say, Christian. And Terry Miles says, good evening, everybody. Isn't that a Slade song? Oh, no, that was Merry Christmas, everybody, wasn't it?
So,
we actually were watching one that Tim likes.
Indeed. And I've done so... The filling I did there was so good, but Kirsty still didn't show up. Right, here we go. The Curse of Fenric starts with...
Wait, Master.
Oh, my God.
Which version? Yes.
Oh, come on. We watched the broadcast version or as close to as much as possible. And you know this, Kirby.
Okay, I've got to bring that one up.
Oh, God. Ugh. Actually, no, what I was going to do, I was going to send everybody...
I just watched the one that I could find on the 24-hour movement.
Well, Do you say 24-hour movement? Or have you got some sort of bowel issue as well?
No, you don't like me mentioning the actual title of it. So I changed it to 24-hour movement, and you don't seem to notice.
Yes,
hang on. You mean everybody doesn't have the wonderful Blu-ray set released earlier this year?
Yeah.
Kirsty has it.
I have it.
Oh, Kirby has it.
Kirsty's got it, but no, I haven't got it.
No, I was going to say... Anyway. That I was planning to set up a private group, 20 megabyte presenters group, minus Kirby, so as we could all have a little sweepstake as to how long it would take for him to interrupt in seconds. And the winner wins the new competition. It's a very quick and easy one, because everybody keeps saying, apart from Mary, oh, we missed the quiz. Moving on, Doctor Who. I got a vibration then. Don't give it anything important. Enlarge your penis. I don't want to... Oh, for God's sake. right then. So, yeah. So, it begins with some soldiers in rafts, and then a shot underwater of what looks like a Viking boat thingy. And there's some mist, and then they go through this sort of beautiful cave thing. The TARDIS arrives... and the weather when it arrives is actually all right.
Start the video yet?
the weather when it arrives is actually not too bad, but it really does get really rainy as the story gets on, which actually adds to the.
That's what I don't like about that quote when he says, "Well, it's not raining." When the scene before, yes. It literally was chucking it down.
There's one scene where it's almost like it's in between showers and there's really bright sunshine, and next one it's actually tanking down.
In every single interview. Where you have Sylvester talking about filming this, he always mentions the same little thing where you open up, he opens up the door, and the weather's different every time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you notice many scenes throughout this, especially when they're in the worst downpours, it's brilliant sunshine right behind them.
Yeah.
So you know that it's movie rain, it's not real rain.
Yeah, something they were able to fix with the special edition where they were able to go in and regrade the picture throughout, so you have a lot more consistency in terms of weather and color tone. But it's in the broadcast version, the weather is all over the place.
Yes.
There's an extra where they're going and looking at the location, and they also do a test of what it's like to film while you have a hose doing rain in front of the. In front of the camera.
Hose, isn't that some sort of country and western thing? So I'm
you've got a tumbleweed then.
Wasn't obviously a joke. I was just trying to do a bit of filling, so just to give Kirsty a chance to join.
No idea what you're talking about.
Hose. Is that something to do with country and western?
Hoedown. It's called a hoedown.
A hoedown. Okay, nearly got it right.
Anyway, yeah, hose is something completely
that's
different.
That's to do with some purchasing of sexual favours. Is that correct? No, I'm too innocent. I don't know what you're talking about. Anyway, these soldiers arrive on a rocky shore, and they're a bit foreign. It's an implication that they're Algerian, and then suddenly they're Russian. And then
Algerian.
I got something like that. I don't know. There was a mention of Algeria, unless I misheard it.
One thing which is really strange between the broadcast version and the special edition is the subtitles of when the Russians are speaking.
Yeah.
It's so weird looking in the broadcast
version. Oh, yeah, with those little dots. Dot matrix sort of thing, yeah. Mm. Mm. Anyway.
That's right.
The Doctor and Ace... surrounded by soldiers all pointing guns at them. And if any of those soldiers obviously shot one of those guns, they would have also shot one of their colleagues as well. So it was a strange sort of way to approach someone threateningly with guns. But anyway, they didn't shoot them. They sort of, the Doctor barged his way into the setup and introduced himself to the little chap in the wheelchair. What was his name?
Dr. Judson.
Judson, that's it. And of course,
you mean Alan Turing?
What?
You mean Alan Turing?
He was based
on Turing.
He doesn't look like Benedict Cumberbatch to me, Kirby.
No, he doesn't.
Anyway, that's a breakaway from this nonsense.
And instead of the because at the time in 1989 you couldn't talk about homosexuality, they substituted his being disabled as being.
Okay, right then. Anyway, And so now we can introduce Kirsty Bissett.
And the halftime score, Perry Vale's 600 million, the rest of the universe, no.
Oh, no, we all used that one. You have to try a different one.
No, we didn't. Don't listen to him. Don't listen to him.
Yes, Kirsty.
You're kidding me, right? Nobody used that one, right?
You're probably nobody not surprised to hear that we've hardly got anywhere in the story at all because we've got this captured chap called Kirsty. Because Kirby on the podcast, that's going to make this awful for me.
I don't know if I should be hurt or what by that one.
I'll be hurt. I would be. Right then.
And also, confused with such a pedant. I never.
In the room with
we had got three of the worst pedants on the podcast today, you know.
I prefer pedant. You do you, Kirby.
Anyway, back to the blimmin' story. We also
have... What story is that, then?
The one we're doing now.
I didn't see any onions. Blooming onions?
What?
Oh, dear.
Anyway, the woman that was in the story of Freema Agyeman, you know, with the hospital goes to the moon, that woman, she's
missing her bindi straw.
Anne Reed.
That's the one. Anne Reed. That's it. Very well known.
Interesting that she gets attacked by hemivores in this and ends up being a plasmavore.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about our recasting in other roles in Doctor Who, but to be in such a, you know, it's like, oh, she went hemivore to plasmavore.
Well, that's cool. I like it.
On RTD's.
Oh, he's so clever.
I think he mentions it in the making of the writer's tale.
Ah, yes, I haven't read that in donkey's ages.
Yeah, I think it's in there.
Which is actual measure of time.
Anyway, back to the story. So the doctor is introducing, poking his nose in, introducing himself, barging his way into the inner sanctum of what's going on at this base.
I love how he does master.
He does master. I didn't see him doing that.
How he does creates his own credentials and signs Winston Churchill.
Yes. That's very
and
doctor-ish.
Stuart Menzies, who was the head of MI6 at the time, who was overseeing what would have been the code-breaking efforts at Bletchley Park that this is based on.
The soldiers that arrive are just sitting on the beach, and then we see some spooky underwater shots of this sort of figurehead of the Viking boat.
Figurehead.
Is it a figurehead?
It's a wolf figurehead. It's their stylized wolf dog figurehead type.
And somebody finds a file on the beach that contains a picture of Dinsdale Lansden, and I've got a sneeze coming. Yeah. And they that's quite interesting.
I find it fascinating that Kirby often offers up factoids and information that nobody asked for. But when Adam's sitting there going, "What kind of a head is that? Nothing." Absolutely nothing. Debbie leaps in, saves the day, and adds some factoid information.
I didn't notice that it was a wolf cat. Thank you.
God. Anyway,
I thought you knew everything, though.
No.
Don't you have the Blu-ray?
Besides, we've got Kirsty and Matthew on here. Both of them know a lot more about this than I do.
Kirsty missed the unofficial extra title of the podcast today. What was that, Adam?
I can't remember. the Wind Up Kirby, 20 megabyte Wind Up Kirby podcast. In fact, it seems to be backfiring somewhat.
And it's the War of the Pennants today.
Anyway, back to the show. The next scene is of this soldier who looks like he's a little boy. He's about 14 years old. So, and there's some very sort of cool lighting going on. The sun's out, but they've sort of dimmed the picture to create a really good atmospheric effect. The sort of thing you'd see in modern productions. And just moving forward a bit. Then we meet the vicar at St. Jude's Parish Church, played by the legendary Nicholas Parsons.
You might say.
Welcome to Just a Minute.
Parson at every corner of the globe. Anyway, and the two girls that come out of the church obviously are refugees. Not refugees, no, what are they called? But they move people out of London.
Evacuees, yes.
Pardon?
Can't stand these two.
Well, they're not refugees, are they? They're
evacuees.
Evacuees, that's it, yes. One of them used to be in Grange Hill.
Not me.
The dark-haired one.
I said that, yeah.
The dark-haired
evacuees is the answer that we're looking for.
The dark-haired one used to be in Grange Hill. I played a very similar character, funny enough. And the matriarch is quite familiar. Seen her in a few things.
She might be able to give you the shipping forecast if you're down for that kind of thing.
Might she? Oh, is she the voice of the speaking clock?
She's Mrs. Bale.
She's what?
Oh, yes.
Ooh.
She's Mrs. Bale in As Time Goes By. She's the one with the shipping clock forecast.
Yes, the sitcom with Jeffrey Palmer and the late Jeffrey Palmer. The late Jeffrey Palmer,
yeah. Absolutely and she wonderful.
She later, in Modern Who, gets menaced by the mummy on the Orient Express.
Orient Express, correct.
Oh, yes.
Thank you for that.
Anyway, let's get back to the story, shall we?
Yeah, so we meet these girls, evacuees, or teenagers. It's funny, just because they're teenage girls, Ace immediately hits it off with them and becomes temporary friends. And they sort of ask her, they've only just met her, but they ask her that she'd like to go for a swim down at Maiden's Point. Yes?
Well, I guess the whole reason for that is it's, if you notice throughout the story, she's kind of torn between these two worlds. There's the adult grown-up world where a woman of roughly her age has a child and everything and responsibilities, and then there's these young girls that remind her of herself, and so that's basically what's being addressed in the story. Anyway,
yeah, because this is the middle part of what could be called the Ace trilogy this season. Because in Ghostlight, which we talked about last week, they're dealing with where she came from and her past, which is why it's all centered around the house. Here, they're dealing with her present and who she is. That she's growing up. She's also the tension she has with her mom, and of course, with survival next week, talking about where her future and where she's going. Though it's more. While definitely they were intending to kind of explore those ideas, it was not originally meant to have been in this order at all.
No.
In a slightly different world, Fenric actually would have opened this season rather than been the penultimate story of it. But, you know, it's one of those happy accidents, I think, in terms of the thematic stuff that they repositioned the season the way they did.
I agree.
And the reference still sounds good even in this, because it just makes it sound like she's talking about what they just went through, but she's not elaborating on a whole lot of the details because she doesn't really know this person. It's just like, yeah, there was a spooky house once. It's like, yeah, we were just there last week.
Yeah, we were there.
Yeah, it's a line that I think would have been lost otherwise. You know, nobody would have thought of, you know, but this way it's a reference that we do get.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Then we meet Commander Millington, who, and that's the last time I'll remember his name, but the face is very familiar. I've seen him in something else. Anybody
Master?
Know?
I don't like him.
Master?
Yes?
In the Royal Navy at the time, one could not have just a mustache. You either were clean-shaven or full beard. Never just a mustache.
You've been waiting to tell me that, Kirby, so I didn't even make
a note about it.
Fantastic. Well, anyway, we meet him. He's a bit sinister. And, of course, the first time we see him, he's sort of got lots of Nazi paraphernalia around him, which makes us immediately think that he's...
He's
looking for the Nazis, which of course he isn't.
That is very real. They had a room set up that looked exactly like the Nazi Central Command, so that the guy, you know, so they could think like. I mean, that's real. That's absolutely what happened.
Yeah.
Next, if you don't know that, if you see that and you go, ooh.
Yeah, but no, that's what it's designed to do, so I liked it. Anyway.
Right, and they come back to it later. I think it's a couple of scenes from now when Millington and Judson are talking, and he's like, you have to get inside the Nazi mind to understand their cipher. So it comes back and explains itself rather nicely.
It does, yes.
That was one of my possible quotes.
Yes.
Yeah. The big thing that's missing out of the middle of the scene is that if you watch the broadcast version, he just suddenly sits up and is like, huh? There's a whole thing missing out of the middle of it where the British sergeant or whatever walks in to try and say something to him, and Millington's just so absorbed in his thoughts, he takes no notice. And then it's the door closing that makes him suddenly sit up.
Right. Where do we get up to? Oh, yeah, the doctor goes and meets Nicholas Parsons in the church. Dr. and Ace, sorry, meet him.
How did you know he wasn't wearing any underwear? The vicar.
<How'd>
I bet he's never heard that one before.
Anyway. there's some runes that Dinsdale Lansden and the woman out of the Jadoon thingy are looking at underneath the church. Because apparently the church is...
Call her Bendy Straw.
Miss Bendy Straw.
Plasmophore.
Okay. Yeah, apparently these are... the church was built on a Viking grave site, apparently.
As
you are.
Yeah.
Why does it look like a fortress? Why does it keep looking like a fortress?
I don't know.
Yeah, the waste can call it out.
Yeah.
And in the graveyard is indeed some remnants of gravestones that indicate a Viking family history within the town.
Wasn't until the most recent watching of this that I realized that the reason there's subsidence between underneath that particular gravestone is because they've been digging underneath there.
Yep.
Kind of duh.
Yeah.
And everybody see the early reference to Millington on the gravestone?
Yes.
Oh, no, I didn't see that. Well done, Kirsty, for picking up on that one. Where is it? I've lost it.
Yeah, down. It's like, oh, Millington. Bing.
I've got my bell. Shall I do it upside down? There we go.
Yeah.
On the feed, Robert Vince Jr. says
Robert were with us, and he could ring a bell. And
it was Robert. I was trying to read it out. She talks of the evil house to her grandmother. Neil James says, loads of shagging at Maiden's Point, apparently. And Laurie Nix posted a GIF which says, this is getting good. Obviously not talking about this show. And that Neil James started it all with a good evening, guys. Right. So the teenage girls are getting moaned at by the battle axe matriarch, who's basically telling them they're evil. And
there's a reason for that, which isn't in any of the screen versions, but it is in Ian Briggs's novelization. It was something he had scripted that got cut out, which was that when she was much younger, she used to go down and meet a guy down there, and she ended up having a child out of wedlock that died young because of it. That's why she's ostracized from kind of the rest of the village, and is become as stuck up as she is.
I didn't know that.
I got one up on Kirby. Adam, can I get a
I was actually curious.
Whatever, right then.
They did mention it on the Blu-ray. That you know.
Oh, you have the
they
Blu-ray.
Didn't go, yes, I've got the Blu-ray. Got it before you.
I think I got it before both of you. Who's being pedantic?
Oh, stop.
Yeah,
we all are.
I knew that was
but it was good because he didn't say what it was. He said she has her reasons for this being her reaction to them wanting to go there, and which was cool, but in the story it's just kind of like, wow, major B much, you know?
Rip, 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 rip.
Those dogs.
I probably cursed these.
Oh, was it? My puppies.
Right then, so the Doctor and Ace go down to the, what's it called again? Maiden's Point?
Maiden's Point.
That's it. And the Colonel, is it Commander or Colonel, sort of starts bullying Dinsdale Lands a little bit because he's got this machine which not only cracks codes, but it they want to try and basically send it to Russia, is it? I haven't got to that bit yet, but the plan is genocide in relation to the Russians.
They're going to booby trap the thing that they've got they know the Russians want, and then they can trigger it whenever they want.
Yes.
Yeah.
Doctor, with the word love.
The Doctor, with his rather cool duffel coat, goes to see Nicholas Parsons again.
Exciting and new. Sorry. Come aboard.
The two teenagers decide to go for their little swim and try sort of goad Ace into doing it. And you're a bit of a worse sort of thing. Ace doesn't.
Later on, when they turn into hemivores, they go into the water. They don't have swimsuits on, but here they happen to have swimsuits in April.
Because Miss Hardacre found their bathing suits a little later. Remember, it took them away from them, and they ended up running away.
Okay.
Thank you. That's a point.
I haven't seen this story 500 times.
And there's another shot of the ship, and then the Doctor starts sort of working out some of the runes, and the girls, they're sort of they've had their swim and they're wandering in the direction of the shore, and with a soldier pointing a gun at them saying, don't come any further, don't come any further. And then they change direction just in the nick of time. In hindsight, it probably would have been better for them if he had shot them.
Well, they do end up getting shot multiple times, yes. So at least they only would have got shot once.
In hindsight, it'd be better if they'd been shot, honestly.
Yes! Well, they end up dead anyway.
You think better?
But that's, of course, an evil plan.
Like, quite right.
Yeah, it might have been a slightly quicker death, but I'm not sure if you gave me a choice, I'm not sure I'd pick either one, to be honest.
Anyway,
quick and merciful, or become a pawn.
When you say immersive, I was thinking of the water.
Depends
and everything.
Depends on where you get shot is half the problem now, with that.
It did seem like they were enjoying being hemivores.
Excuse me. Kirstie just said, quick and merciful. I've just seen a bit of a sort of metal-shaped rocky thing taken out of the water, which was immerse. And then, why do I bother on this show? Everybody talks over my head.
Quick and merciful. Words not used to describe the 20 megabyte Doctor Who podcast.
Anyway, so the soldier finds this lump of...
Yes, Kirby.
I need an explanation from the book. What's with the hunks of metal that tingle?
I think it's just something that the hemivores are doing under the sea, if I remember right. Under the sea.
Well, I mean, they're basically hanging out there until they're called. Probably the equivalent of whittling, you know, they just like extract metals out of things and just.
That was not the idea. That wasn't very clear.
Yeah, if I remember right, it's a bit like the sinking ships from the Sea Devils. It's something they're doing to increase their ranks, because you'll notice out of the water a little while later, a couple of the hemivores are sailors. So I think it's meant to be where they've been sinking ships, basically.
That's why you don't go swimming there, because of the really bad undercurrents.
Anyway, so this soldier picks up this sort of bit of rolled up tinfoil. And then we see a shot of some dead bodies under the water.
It does look like that.
He throws it into the water, and it almost gets caught by one of these sort of corpses or zombie type things under the water.
Hemivore, Adam. Hemivore.
Yeah. Right, whatever. Anyway, so the doctor and Ace go into the room where there's all these young ladies, one with a baby, cuddling a super Ted. Looks like a super Ted.
It is
thing, but Super Ted
it is.
Go ahead, Kirby.
It looks like a Super Ted, but apparently the props buyer was looking for real 1940s things, and it happens to just look like a Super Ted, but it is truly a crocheted bear.
Okay. And can anybody help me with the tie-in between Doctor Who and Super Ted?
John Pertwee.
Thank you very much. Played Spotty.
Also, a potential fun fact, baby Audrey here was actually a boy, not a girl, and he was actually the son of the couple who ran the Actors Pub near the Doctor Who production office in Shepherd's Bush, and was actually cast for the role because he was so used to all the, you know, all the chatter and all the sounds in the pub, so they thought, well, he'll make a perfect little baby actor, and apparently he did.
And another thing that I want to insert here.
That's what she said.
In the making of video on the Blu-ray, if I mention I have the Blu-ray, Sylvester and...
He's masterful at this, isn't he?
Anyway.
No eyelid at all, does he?
They're talking about the fact that it is really a baby boy, and Sylvester turns and says, I mean, people are changing sex all over the place.
Anyway, back to the show. So yeah,
I have to say here at this point, you know, when he whistles at the baby, Ida was like, he did that to me, he did that to me. She was so thrilled.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh.
He whistled at Ida. I could suddenly hear the whole of the... room went quiet because he was whistling for Isla. It was so sweet.
Oh,
I didn't know that.
Sorry?
I didn't know that. So that's lovely.
He actually has that talent?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't think he did it when I met him. He's like one of the few doctors I've met.
Isla was talking to him about the fact that she hadn't really seen him in Doctor Who, but she loved him as Radagast. And she was like, did you really talk to the animals like that? And he went, yeah, I can talk to birds or something like that. And the whole of our end of the hall just went silent as he was whittering and whittling for her. She came running back. He whistled for me. It was like, oh.
Yeah, has anyone ever noticed he's in The Hobbit?
What?
Who's in The Hobbit?
I'm making the joke that Sylvester can make in The Five-ish Doctors. Every time he turns,
yes, I know.
Someone else says,
anyway, so the doctor,
you know, I'm in The Hobbit?
Yeah.
No, I hadn't heard that, Kirby.
Have you not seen The Five-ish Doctors?
Several?
I'm messing with you, darling.
You just don't tell very good jokes, that's all.
God. Anyway, right then. Bill McCann says, one of my favorites. I look forward to hearing your podcast later when I have time. We play the contest again, Time Lord. Anyway, so Ace puts her foot in it when she sort of makes, she implies that.
Lots of mud that she puts her foot in.
What? She implies that the baby was born out of wedlock, and obviously the lady whose mum, my husband's away. There's sad news to follow on that front.
It's interesting though that Ace doesn't consider that to be unusual at all. It's kind of shocking when she figures that out.
Yes, while the Colonel and Dinsdale Landon plot.
Commander.
Oh, whatever. And the doctor and
two
Ace.
Two different branches of the armed services, Adam. Two completely whatever. Different branches.
Whatever. Yes, whatever. The Brigadier and the Dinsdale Landon plot. And, Ace and the doctor go down and find a dead body on the beach. And then they get surrounded.
As you would.
Yes.
They get surrounded again, but this time the soldiers are positioned in a sort of better, not shooting themselves way. And that's the end of that episode. Finally get to the end of episode one, 33 minutes into a podcast for a 25-minute episode.
I think by this time I was done with the special edition.
Anyway, the Doctor and Ace don't get killed, but we still keep seeing these shots. Oh, there was a very atmospheric scene where we have the, almost as like, I don't know if it was a coming-to-life thing of the underwater Heme of all thingies, but these runes on the wall sort of start glowing and coming to life as well. It's a bit like Lord of the Rings. It's interesting you mentioned, obviously, Sylvester McCoy's appearance in Lord of the Rings, but these letters come to life very beautifully.
You mean Sylvester McCoy was in Lord of the Rings?
Apparently so.
Oh, don't be so pedantic, honestly.
I can't help it. I was born this way.
Yes, you can. You just don't want to.
Oh, there's a ding.
You honed it.
I've had a ding.
Talent.
I've had a ding. Let's see what this ding's all about. Alicia Pearson. Just warning, like I said at the beginning of the month, we might need some winnings. Good grief. She's after money. Her money. So it's all right. All right, then. So, we had some stuff going down the beach. The doctor picks up all these little metal things, and the hemovores are coming to life. And he keeps going backs and forwards between the church and the base. And the, hang on, what's he, Commander, Colonel? Commander, is it?
Commander.
Yeah, he's looking very edgy, the Commander bloke, because he's, he corners Ace and the doctor in the sort of like a library. And basically points a gun up the doctor's nose. And of course, we've got to mention
very short,
Nicholas Parsons is struggling with his faith, which obviously faith is quite an important part of this, because if you've got faith, you're sort of protected from the hemovores by a high-pitched noise that occurs when you sort of concentrate on your faith.
Well, we should try that.
Yes. Some green stuff comes out of a little spout in the wall, by the way. And then let's move forward a little bit.
Sounds like a medical problem.
Because Kirby held us back so much from having moved forward a little bit. There's a very nice conversation between Ace and Nicholas Parsons in the church, which I liked, and it was very modern. And then, of course, there's a point in which the doctor finds out that the plan that they have with the green stuff that's going to kill people, basically, little device is rigged with.
How did they discover that stuff was under there? Is that explained in the book?
It's not that I remember of, anyway. But it's very much based on things that the British were doing during the war. There's an island, I think, in the Upper Hebrides, if memory serves, that I think to this day is still uninhabited because they ran biological and chemical warfare experiments on it. And the ground is actually still covered to this day with anthrax spores.
Wow.
So they basically had to pay off the residents of the island to basically never come back.
Okay. Whatever you do, don't mention the war.
Yes.
Laurie Nix says, Hades, help us get through this podcast. I'm trying, Laurie, I'm trying. The doctor walks into this big room where lots of like torpedo things are stacked up high, which they do like they're all stuck, look like they're all stuck together. But then when they're all stacked high, and these torpedo things are the
master.
Oh God.
Bloody hell.
The crew referred to that room as the nipple room.
Splendid. Anyway, so he finds that these things are going to be filled up with
very
this.
Distracting every time they were on screen because I just kept seeing them all this big, this pyramid of molded plastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. It did not look real at all.
And it didn't. Wow. That's what I was alluding to, Kirby. But it's scenery and it's the best they could do at the time, so I accept it. Yeah, so then the commander bloke shows the doctor a lovely thing of some lovely little creatures getting killed by some green...
They were doves.
All right, they're still creatures. It doesn't matter whether doves or not.
Symbolic.
They get killed by this green smoke.
Is what Kirby is getting at.
Yes.
Meanwhile, the little boy soldier comes down and there's a hole in the wall. Some little sparks come out of it and he reaches in. There's a... like a little vase thing. It looks a bit like one of those old-fashioned things you used to wee in hospital. And he just throws it on the floor. Fortunately, it doesn't break.
Speak for yourself, Adam.
The girls go for another swim, and then some mist comes along, and they disappear.
Need to go to the hospital to go pee.
It's moving on.
When you're... I got you now, sorry. It wasn't fun, yeah.
It's all right now. I'm just moving forward a little bit in episode 2. Hang on, this is the bit where that bit. That's what bit you were talking about, Debbie. That's worth doing, wasn't it? Just for your sake, and for Isla's that matter. The doctor's been deciphering some of these runes, and the one bit says, "Let the chains." Oh, I lost it. Never mind.
Let the chains of Bendrick shatter.
Yeah. And now the girls obviously have disappeared in this mist, and they now come back. In that time, their nails have grown, so they've been down to the, you know, the nail bar, and they've got these very long nails.
Right next to the sandbar.
They look a bit pale and menacing.
Oh, come on, that was good.
No one. And they tempt this soldier into the water, and then he gets grabbed by these hemivores. What? Jeez.
His helmet goes floating off. I don't believe a steel helmet would float.
Why wouldn't it come? A steel blimmin' steamship would float.
Okay, fine.
I'm with Kirby. I don't think it has the buoyancy to necessarily do that, because the World War II era helmets were quite heavy. But I'm just imagining somebody just out of camera range seeing it floating away going, no, we spent too much money on that. Get it back.
Yeah.
Well, they did have a problem during that scene with bystanders, people who were watching. They were singing the song, that fundraising song from a couple of years back, and they actually, it was their only take, so they had to play around with the sound, and they managed to remove it.
An editor's life.
Come into the water. You know you want to come into the water.
It's another symbolic thing, because he's feeling, the Russian sergeant's feeling guilty because he's killed those British soldiers earlier. And he's basically gone away from the group because he's feeling guilty about it. And then that's how they lure him into the water.
To the water by the siren ladies.
That's right, yes. Anyway, what was I going to say? Welcome to the 20 Megabyte Helmet podcast. Right then. So that he does get tempted into the water by these young teenagers. There's a great scene in which... Ace goes to see Dinsdale Lansden, who's trying to work out the code, but she tells him its logic, and it's a moment of really, really strong moment for Ace that she can actually show she's not as blimmin' stupid as everyone's making her out to be. And the next scene is the dead soldiers floating in the water, followed by the girls attacking the matriarch battle axe woman.
As one does.
Yeah. At this moment, the weather's quite nice. The Doctor and Ace find her dead, and the Doctor closes her eyes. And then the two girls start closing in on Nicholas Parsons in the graveyard. But he uses his Bible to fend them away temporarily. And then they run off through the woods. And the little vase that was found a few moments ago starts glowing. And all these hemivores start walking out of the water. It might be a little bit of was that one with Adric, the first one? Full Circle, as they came out of the water. Only
That's
better.
Where I remember. Okay.
Only
the
better.
The name Dinsdale's been bothering me. It's the Piranha Brothers. Yes, okay. Monty Python.
Mr. Dinsdale.
Oh, jeez.
Yes.
Anyway, yes, and there's a printout coming out of the ciphering machine, which is so far as I can't read it.
It's the names of the various people who going down the generations who have been affected by the quote unquote Curse of Fenric. So it starts out with the Vikings, and as it goes along, you'll see if you pause, and he says being pedantic, if you pause it, you can actually read out names as they're going. It goes way off into the future as well, so that by the end of it, you've actually reached the Ancient One.
Sorry, just seeing what Laurie Nix has said. So Ian Kirk says the high pitched faith noise might be feedback. Terry Miles says kettle's on. I wish it was. And Laurie Nix says I thought there was a rule against more than two pedants on the podcast at one time.
Well, there's a pedant revolt on the
podcast
show today.
Sometime too, because she's rather pedantic as well.
Yeah. Anyway, I will say that the hemivores as they come out of the water, the hemivores look amazing. They're still gruesome and scary now, but you know, this was made a long time ago. Great costumes, great makeup, fantastic. Wouldn't be out of place in modern Who, so I don't care what you
look
like.
They really look good. Although, have you seen what it was originally going to look like with kind of a sucker mouth? It was really scary.
Yeah, okay. So, Matt, back to episode 3 now. Oh, bloody only episode 3. God. And this is a point where the weather turns, which again adds to the sort of atmosphere of the thing.
It always turns.
The Doctor, i.e. Sylvester's carrying this umbrella, which he's desperately trying to keep over the other actors, but it's great that you can hear the rain.
The movie rain, you know, brilliant sunshine everywhere else.
Well, on this one, it's pretty dull.
The bit where she falls over at the end as well, it's like, oh God, that was a horrific day.
This particular scene, it is dull, and I think it is actually raining, but there were other scenes where you could see it was sunny and they added the rain. Ace is getting more and more attached to the baby as the story goes on. And of course the girls join their new hemivore, which is I do like that the fact that they're obviously hemivores now themselves, and you've got these really ugly, hideous hemivores that have been dead for quite a long time, and these, I have to dare I say it, quite pretty girls, and there was a lovely balance there. I quite liked that with between them leading them and these. Yeah, I was quite clever. Artistically, quite clever. Anyway, so Ace, they're back in the under church, and Ace decides that she's going to have this vase thing and puts it in her backpack. And they find some information about the Sundviks, is it?
The Sundviks.
Yeah, Sundviks, that's it. And then, but while they're in the church, they suddenly get sort of hemmed in by a load of hemivores. Hang on, I've got a burp coming. See that, Kirby? I stifled it. See that?
I'd like to interject for a second. Laurie, if there was a rule about the amount of pedants on this show, I think we would know about it. I mean, we have enough pedants.
Oh,
checkmate.
Robert Vence Jr. says, bad they didn't find a Viking cow helmet. Yes. I think that wouldn't have gone down very well with the historians. Anyway, so they have to battle these hands. And Ace does, again, very, very well in this scene. She legs it to the roof. And then she, in her backpack, she's got this little, like, rope ladder thing which she throws down. And there's a great camera work here. As she's climbing down, there's some view from her angle of her hands on the rope, which looked like GoPro, which wouldn't have been around
there.
Yeah,
it's almost like a
GoPro. Again, you bring a helmet camera.
Oh, was it?
The stunt woman.
Yeah. Oh, was it? But either way, they were fantastic. This sequence is absolutely fantastic with the rope ladder.
And I love how it's finally another use for that rope ladder she's always carrying around.
Yeah.
But the master,
what?
As the doctor also uses faith to keep them away. It's the first time we see it.
Faith Brown. Wasn't she in the Cybermen story? Faith Brown. Attack of the Cybermen, wasn't it?
It's not made very clear, but the doctor is saying the names of former companions.
Yeah.
Oh.
I know Susan, Ian, Barbara, Vicky, and Stephen are the ones that are most clear.
Yes.
And by the time that they all leave, at least according to the script, he's supposed to be on, I think it's Joe and Sarah Jane, but you can't quite hear that with the way the soundtrack is.
I wish it
had been more something that you could tell more that's what was going on.
Yeah.
It took the info text for me to find out.
Okay. Mm. Yeah. All right. Anyway, there's a bit. She has a trouble getting down this ladder. Hang on, me slider's given up on Kirby. Anyway, and then she gets down to the bottom of the ladder, and there's another load of hemivores that grab her, and there was one that grabbed her in a very personal place. I don't know if that was deliberate. And then, fortunately for her, the soldiers turn up and rescue her, essentially.
She's about to get hemivored. Apparently.
Yeah. Anyway, but it's a great scene. Really is. The doctor and the doctor then, like you say, he uses his Time Lord powers. Now, there was a mention a couple of weeks ago with the doctor touched somebody on the head and either knocked him out or something like that. The doctor, Time Lords in general, have had this ability for a long, long time. And I know that obviously they talk about Pertwee's Venusian ability, this ability.
Do listen, Kirby.
Anyway,
I heard.
Like Venusian Aikido, which obviously there was a bit of that Pertwee cheated with while I'm doing it. And if we bring it forward to Capaldi, who was able to do it, and more specifically, Tennant did it, use that power to, you know, to save Donna's life in some way, by taking Dr. Donna out of there. So there's a lot of this ability to touch and knock people out and stuff like that, which he doesn't use a lot, but when necessary. And this is, again, an absolutely amazing scene, because it's out of the blue, and it just changes the scene completely. And it makes the Doctor, because, you know, he's not... Because the first two series, let's be honest, I know you won't like it, you Seventh Doctor fans, but they really did make him into a bit of a buffoon for these first two series. This series is the Doctor. Very, very much the Doctor, and very, very much the Doctor you see of the Seventh Doctor in The Big Finish. This is fantastic stuff all the way through. He rules these episodes, and these scenes are just fantastic.
Yeah.
And he does that scene so well as well. And it's well directed. It's very atmospheric again. It's really, really beautifully done. And that he just holds them off enough with his psychic powers, which he has, which the Doctor has, to get them a bit of time. So them and a few soldiers make their way down underneath the ground. The Ace gets a couple of nitro-9 canisters out, and they get cornered by some hemivores, but the main soldier chap, whose name I forget, uses his faith in the Soviet Union, I suppose, to fend them off.
In the revolution.
Yes.
Evolution.
Something that's missing from the broadcast version that's in the special edition is that when, if you wonder how the Soren and the other Russian troops get off the rooftop, there's a shot in the special edition where it turns out that the hemivores have actually been staked through the heart, a la traditional vampire lore. because a couple of scenes before that, if everybody remembers, Soren is actually making the stakes at the top of the cliff when they're watching the Hemivores go by.
Yep.
So they actually get to use them in the special edition.
As they're approaching the tower, you can see them in his backpack.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I noticed, too, was them in the backpack, but then we never get to see them used.
Yeah, we're doing the special edition.
Yes,
available on the Doctor Who Season 26 or Sylvester McCoy Season 3 Blu-ray set.
All right, anyway. So
the Blu-ray set.
The Blu-ray set. You know, I gotta get that.
I think with Sophie Aldred as well, mentioning Soren the other day, she definitely has a soft spot for that character
I'm going to have a scratch on my back with my magic
wand. Well, I'll mention it when we get there, but there's
if
a further tie into that in the novelization, but I'll mention that when we get to the end, I think.
If we get to the end.
Show off.
Anyway,
I am nerd. Hear me, bore.
So if we can move forward a little bit, the Doctor, Ace, and the Vicar managed to get out of the this underground tunnel, which arrives at the base. Was it the base? I think it's the base. Anyway, it comes at the other end, and then they just shut the door and allow the soldiers to die. And the Doctor pleads with the commander bloke, who says, "No, I've got what I want." Anyway, so it's a harrowing scene for the Doctor, and just moving forward a little bit. And then of course the husband of lady with baby. Is he dead or just missing in action?
I think he's presumed to be dead.
That's implied that he's dead.
Yeah, he's missing, presumed dead. I think is the way they phrase it.
She seems quite upset about this.
We just don't see the body.
Yeah, and we're sorry we apologize and have our condolences. Kind of implies that he's gone.
Okay. Mm.
And her name is
getting better.
And then we get this scene here, which is quite good.
Are they Mary?
I said her name is Kathleen.
That's nice name. That my daughter's middle name.
Also, lady with a baby, but her name is Kathleen.
Yeah, lady with baby.
Another great scene between Sylvester and Sophie.
You know what's going on, don't you?
Yes.
You always know. You just can't be bothered to tell anyone. It's like it's some kind of a game and only you know the rules. You knew all about that inscription being a computer program, but you didn't tell me. You know all about that old bottle, and you're not telling me. Am I so stupid?
No, that's not it.
Why, then? I want to know.
Evil since the dawn of time.
Oh, I could play the whole lot, but yeah, that's a great scene.
That is one of my favorite scenes.
Yes.
I wanted to, that's the difficult thing when you start the show, is like you say, do a quote. It's like, I want to do some of these, but it's too lengthy for the intro for a show. But it's like, some of these I just want to be able to go, I'll do this bit.
Yeah.
Because they are just fantastic. You know, that the interplay between the two of them there, the way she gets at him.
Yeah.
Am I so stupid? You know, and it's just like, whoa.
Yeah. But that culminates in this scene.
We can release Captain Soren to help us. I can distract the guard.
How?
Professor, I'm not a little girl.
Which then leads to quite an uncomfortable scene of her flirting with with a quite easily led, shall we say, captain.
Fred was watching that scene last night, and she's going, she's just saying things.
Yeah.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, I have no idea what she's saying.
She's doing it with her eyes, at the flirtation. And I felt that the soldier did not look like a young Peter Capaldi. But anyway, so moving on. Oh, yeah, there's another scene.
To be fair to the soldier, who knows the last time he had leave, so.
Yeah. There's another scene in which...
I like how you put that. Oh. The last time he had leave.
There's another scene in which Nicholas Parsons tries to sort of fend off the Hemivores, but he has a little go at it, but they manage to talk him round and... I think
they talk him round.
They talk him back into not having
not
any faith
anymore. Yeah, they convince him.
I like how you approach this. It's like, oh, they talk him round. That's all right.
That's actually what they do. They sort of say, "Come on, you haven't got any faith," and they.
Well,
that's
a nice way of putting it.
Then they're back in the base, and Dinsdale Lansden's eyes go all green. Oh, yeah, he stands up first because he gets laid out first, then he stands up, and then his eyes turn green, and then he becomes the Incredible Hulk. No, sorry, that's a different story.
Otherwise, my favorite Doctor Who cliffhanger ever.
Yeah. Finally made it to episode 4.
Out of that wheelchair.
Delighted to say, finally made it to episode 4. All hell breaks loose.
This one out for, I wonder.
Oh, that's okay. We'll hold out for a special edition.
There's some great stuff goes on here.
And spot all the changes for the special edition.
There's a scene in which I'll have to play it so if you remember it, but Dinsdale Lansen's face goes all blurry, but it's really quite effective. Oh, yeah, all the windows break in, but there's a great special effect around his face and that.
If you have a surround sound system and you watch the special edition, Mark Ayers, when he did the remastering for the 5.1 mix, that sound, and I used to have a surround sound system. I don't anymore. My uncle gave me his old one, and I had it for about 2 or 3 years before it got hit by lightning. But I was able to watch this a fair few times. That sound effect actually whips around the entire speaker system and goes around your head. Cool. It is quite an effect.
Anyway, so the Doctor, Ace, and the soldier chap, whose name I keep forgetting, are lined up.
Yes. Thorin!
I know he is, isn't he? But anyway, lined up against the wall, and they're just about to get shot when some hand grenades and stuff explode, and all hell breaks loose again. And it's quite funny, like you say, that they're hiding under an umbrella in the rain, and they can quite clearly see the sunshine in the background.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Again, something they fixed for the special edition.
Yeah. And then the girls go down to the beach and summon the Great Heme of Orb. What's the name of the Great Heme of Orb again?
The Ancient One.
The Ancient One.
Yes. Or the Great Heme of Orb, which sounds really good.
I like the Ancient One. What a piece of makeup and special effects that is. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of singing the praises a couple of weeks ago of the great Destroyer of Worlds that was in Battlefield. This is much better.
Yeah. Isla thought this one was better than him.
Cartmel's book, he's very disappointed, actually, in the head of the Ancient One.
I don't know why.
Yeah, mostly it's the mouth, because he says that there was no way that he could talk without the mouth flopping all over. So they ended up having to do so much to the mouth to stabilize it that it ended up, it couldn't move at all. So he just had to talk and watch the mouth not move.
We don't see Cybermen's mouth
move,
do we?
I think that actually works, because the Hemivore seemed to be communicating psychically anyway, so it makes sense that, because that's how I've always interpreted it, is he's communicating telepathically rather than talking with his mouth. It's a rather neat effect.
But he still did not like the Hemivores in general, or that one in particular.
Terry Miles says the special edition is also on DVD. Robert Vence Jr. says, great speech. Thank you, Robert. And then he says, lol, walked him back. And then he says, congratulations, episode 4. And then he said, reminded me of State of Decay. Oh, what?
Master.
What?
I'm contractually obligated mention this because Matthew brought it up. In the scenes in the tunnel with the Hemivores and the two girls are walking ahead. The day they filmed that, Sylvester's sons were on set. Mm. So look for the two smaller Hemivores. Those are his sons.
Okay.
A bit of info. Bing.
Ding, whatever. Right then. Where do we get up to?
Ding!
That's a chessboard, isn't it? Because the Doctor wants to have a game of chess. There's a lovely the scene where they retrieve the chessboard in amongst the green smoke. Ace realizes that there might be some dynamite under the table. And another brilliant scene where they leg it. The whole thing explodes
and
behind
the
them. As they,
a little too much explosive.
Yeah, as they land in the...
Sandbag. It hits the camera.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, it'll just be a little one.
But I watched that, and it's the umbrella flying, like you say, and it nearly hits the camera. It's brilliant. What a scene that is. And then, of course, there's a conversation with Dinsdale and Dinsdale Lansden. And the thingy. What's it called? The Hemivore? The Ancient One.
Ancient One.
And then there's a shot. There's a scene of all the ladies trapped in this room with the bat phone to hand.
I'm afraid Fred laughed at that scene.
What, the bat phone?
No, the when they all turn into Hemivores, and then attack.
I haven't got to that bit yet, Kirby. Attack. I would have got to that bit under normal circumstances, but I haven't actually got to that bit yet. So meanwhile, it's absolutely tipping down again, and the soldiers are lobbing these grenades full of poison at the other soldiers, which I was a bit uncomfortable about, to be fair. And then
this is war.
Oh yeah, then the soldier who I keep forgetting the name of gives Ace a badge, which is very nice. What was the badge of?
It was okay, the real version of one that she had. That's all I really
know. That's right. That was a nice moment.
Kind of a Russian soldier, commander badge.
I wish we were Russian. We might have actually got through this women's story by now.
I used to know what it was, actually, because I looked it up at one point.
Another joke goes to the wayside. Oh, God.
What's the matter, Adam?
What's the matter?
You fed up with trying to do humor on this show.
When are you going to start?
Well, I had started. You always talk over the blooming best spontaneous jokes I managed to pull up. Anyway, back to the story.
What you need to do is mute the rest of us and then.
How can I? Oh, I've just thought of something spontaneous. I know. I'll just go around the whole of Skype, mute you lot, and then say this not then spontaneous thing after all. Where are we? Oh, yes. The woman from the Jadoom story gets done in by a load of hemophores. And a great smile from Dinsdale Lansdowne, which, is. It's quite creepy, but superb. You don't know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Do you? Oh, you do.
Well, there's the added note that was supposed to, that was apparently shot but taken out and wasn't put into the special edition, which is she's a Russian spy. She's the one who tipped them off.
I wish we were Russian. That still didn't work. Oh, God. Might have got through this episode. I did that joke twice, so that's for the benefit of the listeners who would have probably heard the joke twice.
What joke?
Never mind. Sorry, Matthew.
Try again.
No, I'm not going to do it again.
Will it be really quiet?
Yeah, I'll give you some space, Adam. Please, tell your joke.
Oh, yeah, so all hell's breaking loose within the
that's not funny.
One of the soldiers gets shot by the commander, and Ace and the woman and the baby hide. Ace buys all of them a bit of time to climb out the window. They get the chess set, and the doctor sets up the game. Because the Fenric thingy can't resist a game of chess. And Ace tells Lady to go off to her nan's, where she'll be safe.
And she
tells the baby she'll love her forever. And, of course, the baby is her mum. Which I loved.
Because there's nothing like a predestination paradox.
Indeed. Yes. I don't care. I loved
it.
Did
she just arrive at this person's house and just say, somebody told me to come here, and then she just moved in?
Yeah. Wow. Apparently. I don't mind that. What I do like about that is when I watched this story the first time it went out, that's the part of the story I loved the most at the time, and then everything else about it has come into it a bit later. Right. Yes, anyway, you wanted to ask Kirsty a question.
What?
Kirby sounded like he wanted to ask Kirsty a question.
Who
did you
not?
Did you, dear? You did.
No.
You did, apparently.
It sounded like it. It sounded like Kirby said Kirsty.
Nope.
Good. Right, let's get on then. Right.
You're hearing things.
I'm not surprised.
Sorry, what?
Anyway, so yeah, the girls start threatening. What's her name? Ace. But then. The Ancient One and Fenric decide they're going to do away with all the other hemivores, and they just melt into a rather disgusting heap of bone and dust.
Yeah, that was a bit gross.
And the extras go into gruesome detail of how they did that effect.
Anyway, so, the Doctor's playing...
Lots of acetone.
And there's a scene in which... the blonde-haired soldier is trying to help the other. It's the British soldier and the Russian soldier sort of teaming up as buddies. Mm. But there's almost like
there's a bromance going on there.
Yeah, I had a sense of a bit of a romance more than the bromance there. An implied.
The one soldier that ends up shooting the commander.
Yeah.
He is also the actor who was the destroyer.
Oh. Thank you for that, Kirby. And of course, things moving forward a bit. Oh yeah, and then the bloke who gets all romantic, that gave the badge to Ace, has been taken over by Fenric, and his eyes go green, and he turns into Incredible Hulk. Oh no, that's another franchise. And he goes all threatening, and oh, that's right. And then I think he more or less tells the Ancient One to kill everybody in the whole world. And he just frog marches, the Ancient One just frog marches him and himself into this sort of sealed cubicle and lets off the
You skipped
poison.
Over some bits there.
Yeah, well, I'm not really surprised. We're at 6 minutes past. We've nearly done it, taken as long as it takes to watch the story.
Skipped over the whole point of the story.
Oh, yes. Well, can you summarise it as quickly as possible? Because we could have actually spent more time talking about this bit than we did about the bloody bits in episode 1 and 2.
Ace basically comes to terms with her past and her present and her future.
Yes, well,
and it turns out that Fenric has manipulated everything, that Fenric created the time storm that got Ace to Ice World with.
Yes, but what we forgot to say...
the only reason that the Doctor took up with Ace. Da-da-da.
Yeah. There's been manipulating events, including getting Lady Penfort to 1988 back in Silver Nemesis.
That sounds like Scooby Doo, doesn't it?
That's not Scooby Doo.
Wasn't it? Or is it then?
Muttley. It's Muttley, yeah.
Muttley.
Oh, well done, yes, Muttley.
Huh?
Anyway, there's a good scene amongst that lot. If you wouldn't mind me mentioning it.
What?
If you wouldn't mind me mentioning it, there's a good scene in there in which the Doctor has to break Ace's faith in him. And of course, you get some bit of a huff about this, but thankfully for us, a few words outside.
She was over it in a minute and a half.
Yes. Very good, Kirby.
You took it for a swim off.
You won't get a ding because you've used that joke on countless occasions.
Yes, I have.
And then Ace is, goes for a swim to wash away all the bad stuff, and off they go. Kirsty,
Fred was confused by all the voices under the water.
Yeah, okay. Kirsty, if you'd like to cover anything, I should say Matthew, shouldn't I? If you'd like to cover anything I've missed, but you've got 1 minute to do so. 30 seconds. Hang on, let's get this up on the timer. and let's get the volume right. Oh, where's the volume button? Hang on.
That's from Countdown. That's right. Not from Just a Minute.
Right. Well, you've got 30 seconds to anything I might have missed that you want to mention. 30 seconds starting now.
Right. So, as I may have mentioned earlier, there's a line in the novelization that reveals that Nurse Crane is actually a Russian spy, and she's the one who actually tipped the Russians off to the Ultima machine being here, and she's actually the one who signaled them to land at Maiden's Cove, sort of bringing things full circle. There's a scene at the end of the novelization talking... Yeah, Adam, you were talking about the sort of thing going on between Soren and Ace. There's a scene at the end of the novelization where a future Seventh Doctor and Ace arrive in Paris.
Time's
in the
up.
19th century.
No, sorry. Sorry, carry on.
They arrive in 19th century Paris, where it turns out that Soren's grandfather is there, and there's an implication that him and Ace become a couple. So it's further setting up the whole Wolves of Fenric bringing things together.
Mm.
And of course, the Ultima machine is based on Enigma, the Nazi cipher codes from World War II, which the British effort to decode was known as Ultra. So if you put Ultra and Enigma together, you get Ultima. And my only sort of comment is the computer they use is too small.
Yes,
it's a science fiction, a fantasy TV show.
Colossus, which is the real version of it, which is at Bletchley Park, is much, much larger.
I assume it is, but that's because that's real life. This isn't.
Colossus, the Forbin Project?
I see what you did there, Kirby. There's a movie I haven't seen in years.
Yeah, where it's available.
Anyway, Robert Venge Jr. said, with the great vampire.
They've gone off on their own now. You're...
Yeah, that's it. Bye.
Terry Miles said, Ace sent her nan and her mum to her nan's house. Nice one, Terry. And are we at the stage we can actually talk about this now? Got feedback.
Haven't we been talking about it for the last 70-odd minutes?
I mean, about what we think about it and stuff.
No, apparently, Adam's been trying to do comedy, and we've been interrupting.
I don't know why I'm bothered. All right then, the curse of Fenric. Right. This one of those things that when I watch these stories, and I haven't watched them in several years, I forget how good they are. This is one of those particular stories. Now, the only thing that sprung to mind while watching it that I thought, that wouldn't work. There's a scene in which the soldier enters the room where all the women are now hemivores, and they start approaching him with their long fingers. I would have just opened the door and legged it. He just sort of stood there and allowed them to attack him, basically. That's the only bit I had a problem with. The rest of it...
They have a way of controlling people hypnotically.
Well, that's an acceptable answer.
It's the same thing they do with Reverend Wainwright, the Nicholas Parsons character.
Okay. But this is an absolutely excellent story, beautifully acted, really gripping, horrific in some ways. Love the location. The rain was a bit of a shame, but they couldn't help that. The monsters were great. I know J&G really wanted
rain.
Monsters, but
it's
they
a
did
sunny
work.
Day.
They did work in this particular story. All in all, it was just I was mesmerized by it. It's absolutely magnificent piece of television, and it again, like I say, wouldn't need that much tweaking. Maybe a bit of HD and a few bit of CGI effects on it to make it a decent new Who story. I think this is rather fab. All right, then go on then, Matthew. What did you think of it?
Wait. You said it was too bad about the rain. They made the rain. It was the only way they could create atmosphere on these brilliantly sunny days.
Well, but there were also times when it actually was raining. But
yes,
no.
There were lots of times it was really raining.
And their first full day of filming, it snowed.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, there's a lot of publicity. Yeah, there's a lot of publicity pictures from this story that you can find. Yeah. I know it's on the DVD. I can't remember if it's on the Blu-ray or not. For those who don't have either one, check out the wonderful Doctor Who Tragical History Tour site, which is a collection of Doctor Who photos, which has a lot of those photos. There is snow all over the place.
Yeah. It's like a big blanket of snow.
Anyway, Matthew, what did you think of it?
Watching
I'm going to have a nap
for
a bit.
Wasn't any snow in it.
It's kind of surprising they didn't go for a Claws of Axos rewrite, really, and just said, freak weather conditions over the whole area.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they were expecting to film this in May, and the schedule got messed up. Ended up filming it in April.
You right, fall off again.
Oh, no, I'm trying to get comfortable.
April showers bring May flowers.
Go on and get on with it.
And May flowers bring pilgrims, appropriately for this week.
Actually, I've just thought of something. I could actually go into the other room and watch Murder on CCTV, and then just give me a call back when you're ready to get on with the show. Carry on. I've gone very quiet.
Well, who's next?
Yeah.
Well, about 15 minutes ago, I said, Matthew, what did you think of it? And we're still waiting.
He told us.
It was 5 past 8.
We finished!
I actually didn't hear Adam say that. I just thought we were talking
I will be quick with it.
I will be very quick then.
Just say what you think of it.
Okay. Well, as will come as no surprise to anybody, this is my favorite Doctor Who story of all time.
Yay.
Obviously, that's why I had to be here today. Oh, thank you, Adam. In many ways, I think it's, if you draw a Venn diagram of a lot of my interests outside of Doctor Who, and, they all kind of overlap inside the story that has my favorite Doctor and my favorite companion firing on all cylinders. I think, as you were talking about, Adam, those scenes that we mentioned, or that you mentioned, I should say, of the two of them outside the hut in episode 3, for example, they're firing on all cylinders, and the chemistry between them here is wonderful. And there's a great supporting cast as well, and it's wonderfully made. It's one of only a handful of Who stories from classic era that was made entirely on location, because they did find this disused army camp there, and they said, we'll just make it all right here, which ended up actually being more expensive than if they'd actually shot, part of it in studio. But it looks fantastic. And they, I think a lot of what happens to 80s Doctor Who is they kind of forget that they have to work within the constraints of having a comparative low budget in a multi-camera studio. And you end up throughout Davison and particularly Colin Baker and early McCoy too, you know, writers who bring in scripts that can't be made on the budget, and you end up with shows that look absolutely horrible as a result. Warriors of the Deep is, I think, for me, the classic example. But I think throughout this kind of last season in particular, they realize again that, hey, there are things that we can do. We're a time travel show. The BBC can do costume drama rather well. Why don't we do more historical stuff? But also going for things, the Hemavores, which look amazing, I think, even 30 years on from when this was made. A lot of the production problems that we've talked about, whether it's in the pacing or the sort of discontinuities with the weather, and I'm sure that Kirby and Kirsty will back me up on this. Go watch the special edition that's on – it's on Blu-ray, but it's also on the DVD that was released in 2002, 2003, and is still readily available on Amazon. Go watch the special edition, because the special edition – fixes a lot of the problems that the broadcast version does have in terms of discontinuity, and also fixes the sound mix issues, which drowns out some of the dialogue in places. But in many respects, I think if you had to ask me, not just because it's my favorite, but I think it's a perfect encapsulation of everything that Doctor Who's capable of, because it meshes up science fiction, it meshes up historical, it meshes up horror fiction as well. There's a reference to Dracula thrown in the middle of it, which I absolutely love. And yes, it's just a spectacular piece of work. And I genuinely think it's the second best story of classic Who behind Genesis of the Daleks.
Thank you, Matthew. Debbie, what did you think?
Why do I have to follow such eloquence, honestly?
Well, you did mention in a private feed about... you said Isla loved it, so this would be interesting to hear.
Well, all I'm really going to say about this was terrific. I absolutely love this. I love this first time round. Strong memories of this one all the way through. And watching it with, obviously, Isla again... She won't let me watch Doctor Who now without her, which is terrific. But actually, coming on here and being able to be, you know, cohesive and awake is going to be problematic. But she wants to come on and talk eventually as well. She really has fallen for Ace as a character. She's doing exactly what I did, as I've said before. And obviously we watched Ghostlight last week, but I wasn't well, so I couldn't review really Ghostlight, but she absolutely was into that as a story. She actually started explaining to me what was going on, because she got it. She got Ghostlight.
Good.
And I'm sat there going, I don't feel well. I don't know what's going on. Which way's up? These pills are terrible. And then she's explaining things to me. I'm like, oh yeah.
Sure. All the way through that.
Yeah.
So she got Ghostlight first time round without.
Yeah, she did.
Good.
Yeah, no, she did, and that definitely was more than I did the first time around. But with that story moving into this one, where she obviously references the house, you could just see Isla's ears prick up, and I'm like, I'm looking at myself from this era, you know, because she is roughly the same age I am. So I'm watching her, but I'm seeing what I must have been like when my dad was so thrilled when I was really into Doctor Who. And this is it. Watching it carrying on to another generation is just absolutely wonderful. And she loved the Hemavores. She loved them. We thought they were sirens at first. We called them sirens before we got the Hemavores. Because she was like, look at them beckoning him into the water. Look at their fingers. And all I was reminded of was with those fingers, 1980s dressing up for Halloween when you have the plastic fingers that you put on the ends of your hands to make the glow-in-the-dark witch fingers, yeah, that sort of thing. Oh, my God. And... But with this story, I felt with the music as well, the music was actually really well used in this. The menace, the lighting, the shoot, the way, as obviously was discussed, they shot almost entirely on site. And that was just such, it was evocative. It really was evocative of what they were trying to achieve with the time as well, the time era, and the fact that this time Ace came out ready, which really impressed. Stylish. She's not going to get told off for looking like a trollop now, is she, Mum? It's like, okay. But with the story, just watching Ace go through that whole awful bit at the end where he basically has to destroy his faith in her. And you know it hurts him as much as it hurts her. because he's the Doctor, that's who he is, but he feels everything so strongly. But to have her break like that was just horrible. But then the redemptive swim, I felt they got so much into the last couple of scenes for her as a character. It was so well done. Just enjoyed the clarity for all of us after the adventure we've been on with the Hemavores and being underground and, you know, just being stuck in the tower and with that amazing long ladder of hers that just seems to get longer every time she gets out. That was phenomenal. I thought that was brilliant because I was like, how did she get all that in her bag? And I was like, it's magic. It's, yeah, it's TARDIS back. It's fine. But yeah, that was so good. And just, I know I'm rambling. I'm sorry. But there's so many good little things in it. But I thought it was quite funny that when Ace met Audrey the baby and just went handed her back straight away, but then gets drawn back to her. And we're all basically shouting at her, that's your mum! That's your mum! For the first episode and a half. And just, I do like the sort of reveals that this especially this series has been quite clever in the little reveals to the audience that haven't been like so totally in your face glaring, and they're ignoring the glaring. This is just a great story arc, and I'm looking forward to seeing where we finish with it next week, really, more than anything. But watching Ace and Sylvester together is an absolute treat.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, these are seasons. It's series
one. Right, Kirby. God.
Okay.
I nearly said Kirsty, but we'll go with Kirby. What did you think of it?
Well, so many good comments up to this point. It's hard for me to add anything to it. The only thing is I will say that this is not my absolute favorite Sylvester story. It's really up there. I like it, but I'm actually more confused by this story than I was by Ghostlight.
What?
Well, a lot of the things, like I was asking Matthew, explain this, explain that, because there was enough cut out of it, particularly before I watched the special edition, which I love the special edition, that really helped. It's great. This is a great story, and not much more I can say.
Well, thank you. That's unusual for you.
As we're recording, you know what tomorrow is.
Yeah, it's the Doctor Who birthday date.
Yeah, it's 57 years. Mm.
And today, as we're recording appropriately for what we'll be talking about next week, episode 1 of Survival went out 31 years ago today.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So you're just trying to wedge a gap between the real world and me asking Kirsty what she thinks of it, aren't you?
Yes.
Well, when Kirby asks leading questions like that, you know what this is, don't you? All of us be quiet and let the silence let them know that we don't know.
God. Kirsty, what did you think?
I really, really liked it. I don't know if I always liked it. I always thought it was kind of a really cool story. I kind of came at the series in a weird way, watching it at fan meetups and stuff like that. And so you kind of get impressioned by other people. Watch this bit and whatever. So I've always kind of had this like, oh, it's good, but never really gave it a lot of time. So I got the Blu-ray and watched the special edition.
You have the Blu-ray?
And yes, I have the Blu-ray. And really? I tell you, it is the best way to watch it. Everybody should watch that, because to me, that's what at least a really good portion of the story they were trying to tell. And this time watching that, I understood everything that was going on. There was some other stuff that wasn't included in the story. Like, I found it interesting, the explanation as to what happened between Millington and Judson, is that they were at school together and they were in a relationship and or something like that. And they were out on the rugby field and Judson was giving some other guy the eye, and so Millington kind of charged him from behind and broke his back because he was jealous.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
it's in the novelization. Awesome. It's nothing that's said.
Right. But I mean, I think it's fantastic that was that was in there from the, you know, he had those intentions with the story. It's not something that, you know, then we went back and layered in later. But, you know, because when you see this fleshed out, you see that there's this tension between them, and it's a fantastic story. It's probably, now after watching the special edition, it's probably become my favorite Sylvester McCoy story, because it's just really good. I don't like Millington, the actor in it. I don't think he's very strong. He doesn't seem very commanding. He's just a grumpy old dude. And the two young girls bother me a bit. But it is kind of interesting when you look at interesting how, if you look at it from the point of view of the story, it's like, so it all takes place at you know, this convergence of all of these things, including the fact that, you know, Fenric has orchestrated all of this to converge at this point, including having those two girls, you know, at that point, you know. And so, yeah, it's interesting. It's like, well, this is what time gave you. It's not like, oh, well, we had, you know, beautiful women in their 30s that went into the water and came out, and, you know, no, we just had these two teenage girls that went into the water and came out. So I kind of get that, but yeah, fantastic story.
Thank you, dear.
Done.
Pardon?
You're welcome. Oh. You're welcome.
And particularly interested to hear this one.
Yeah.
Well, just like Ghostlight, when you watch a story that requires explanations, repeat viewings, people having to explain things to you, having to go to special editions where stuff has to be added in and, you know, things laid out for you. I'm in John Nathan Turner's camp on this one. When he told Andrew Cartmell, he says, well, for the people who've been watching, you know, all of these stories and they get all the references and you know, they're able to fill in the blanks, he says, it's probably a great story. But for the average watcher, it's going to be confusing. And that's where I am. Okay, let me get this straight. Ace never makes the connection that this baby is her mother. I mean, we have it figured out shortly after the first conversation with Kathleen and even sending her off to 17 Old Terrace. I mean, the girl has to be incredibly thick to not have made that connection. Like Debbie says, you know, you're yelling at the screen. That's your mom.
I didn't get it at the time I first watched it, but then I didn't either,
I have to say.
Golly, I did
right off. Yeah, we were going, it's your mom!
You know what that means, don't you? We're all a bunch of thickos.
And I'm supposed to buy the fact that Ace has gone from being this sort of, you know, believable, rough-edged teenager. Suddenly, she turns into this vamping seductress. And even the dialogue with that soldier was so stilted. It was so weird. It made no sense at all. Something on a bigger scale. So the Viking pirates or settlers, whatever they're calling them, were supposedly all killed off in a big black fog, but somehow they were able to hang around long enough to father these huge families, all of whom stayed in this area. you know, it's a lot to accept. And when Ace is laddering down or wants to outside the church, the fort church, whatever it is, I'm asking myself, what is she doing? You know, the area is too isolated for her to find help if that's her intent. She never says what her intent is. But it just seems like a really stupid thing, except it put her right down there with all the hemivores that want to attack her. And then the hemivores, they're quick to either convert or drink the blood of their victims. But then they stand there stroking Ace's face and neck for, I mean, a good 3 minutes before she's actually rescued. in that scene where the doctor and Fenric are with each other, and the doctor wants to, you know, dress Ace down as a way to break her faith. It's for that whole scene, Ace is just standing there being threatened, when he could have just said, Ace, come on over here, because he stands there doing that whole scene of discrediting her while everybody just stands around. You know, it's like scenes that I'm very tired of seeing in Doctor Who, where everybody stands around, the threatened people especially.
Well, that's because that's well, because Ace is keeping the is keeping the Ancient One from acting. So he's got, and she's not going to move because she thinks she's doing the right thing in the situation.
Yeah,
well, that rather sort of says proves Mary right that it requires explanation.
Yeah, so everybody stands around, including, you know, the monster, and lets the doctor do his scene. So I had a hard time buying. And in Cardinal's book, he says the reason that these characters are called hemivores and not vampires, because originally they were supposed to be vampires, is because they had to do all daytime shooting. So they knew that vampire would be questioned by everybody. So they had to change it to something daytime believable, like hemivores. And he was very upset that they couldn't do more atmospheric stuff. And he also comments on the fact that he sees the deaths as very unconvincing, the deaths of the victims. You know, everybody, all the hemivores just kind of lean into somebody, and then we're supposed to assume that they killed them or drunk their blood or something. But he said it just looks really fake. And I agree. When I watched it, it's like, you know, I have no idea what happened to these people. They could have escaped for all I know. But that's where I am. You know, here's another story that requires so much more in order to understand and enjoy it. But you just sit there and watch it through, and it's like, well, what about this? And what about that? And that doesn't make sense. And what's this that's going on? So, again, I did not enjoy this story. I think Ghostlight was worse in that department, but I think this one, too, you know, falls into that hole of, you know, you've got to be an absolute nerd or devoted fan to want to do all the repeat viewings or look for the explanations or whatever so that you can figure out what's going on.
Or go on a podcast and have it explained to you by at least three pedants.
Nerds! I mean, nerds!
So what are you doing with your Sunday, Mary?
Okay, this is what Andrew Cartmell thinks.
In Curse of Fenric, we see the return of Ian Briggs. And as with Ghostlight, it has a tremendous strength in that it's a period story where the BBC's ability to evoke an historical epoch is used to perfection, because they could really do us proud on a Second World War story. And that was part of our thinking when Ian and I had sat down to talk about doing Fenric, conceiving what we were going to do before we even had details of the story. We thought a World War II story would be a great period and one that could be very well achieved within our budget by the BBC, who were very strong in that area. And one of the earliest decisions we made was to have it about British soldiers versus Russians, because to be working against the Germans, the Nazis, was just too obvious a ploy. So making them Russians came into it quite early on. Then the whole Viking thing kind of followed on with that. The only regret I have about the way this was presented is that the way the costume they chose for Sophie, because Sophie was one of the most gorgeous young women you could have asked for, and this, I think she's lumbered with one of the most unflattering costumes I've ever seen, totally accurate to the period, but they should have dressed her up in a tomboyish land girl kind of outfit, and she would have looked really gamin, and we would have fully utilized the fantastic look she has. That is one thing that I slightly wince over. Another thing I slightly went over is the chief hemivore, because his jaw is kind of falling. You can see that it's sort of falling off. So that, I always regret that. I mean, I never wanted to go with those rubbery, full-on monster suits. I always wanted to go down the route of minimal makeup and minimal prosthetics, like the vampire girls have. But they wanted full-blown monsters, and I don't think they were. Also worth mentioning is that it was a vampire story, and we wanted bits set at night, and we didn't have the money for night shooting. So Ian wrote, okay, if we can't shoot it at night, we want clouds of black smoke for the creatures to emerge from, you know, to sort of be the equivalent of darkness. You can't do black smoke because it's toxic. So they sort of did some very wispy white smoke. It just didn't work. Aww. So there's a lot of things that just didn't come off in that, in terms of implementing the fantastic script that he wrote. But I think the genius of the script and the fineness of the acting and the extraordinary nature of the concept all still do come through.
So there you go.
Here, here.
Yeah. Right then, so it's time for a bit of... God, look, it's been 25 to 9. It's time for some feedback, Kirby. I think this is your part of the show that where you get interrupted or don't.
Yes, let me find the...
He's not page. Ready!
No, I was updating something and I accidentally closed the Facebook, so hang on. Uh-huh. Here we go.
Oh, God.
Uh-huh, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So
you ready yet?
I was the yeah. I'm ready.
Go on then, get on with it.
Well, I posted a picture showing Ann Reed and Janet Hinfrey in their dual roles.
Yeah.
Robert Wentz Jr. says, "Wow, this sucks." With a picture of Soren being surrounded by
very
the
good. Very good, yeah.
Robert Haynes, vampires do tend to. Suck, that is. Jefferson Lee Eng, you should come into the water with us. Then we'd have been together. Okay, so we get over the jokes now and start having actual comments.
Hooray.
Billy Kirkbright, I've not seen this for years. I started watching it to provide some audio feedback,
yes.
But didn't get a chance to finish watching it due to immediate encumbrances. I got to the end of episode 2, and so far I was captivated,
yep.
Which hasn't happened much in this era. What was that?
Good.
Okay. One positive aspect of the McCoy era is the incidental music, which has been a vast improvement on years gone by. Plus, I found what I saw of the story so far was atmospheric and creepy. Excuse me.
It's like having Robert on the show.
Is Robert joining us?
Robert, is that you?
Somewhat redemptive of recent episodes of the McCoy era. Not to mention the location looked fab, too. I'll look forward to the next 2 episodes. Robert Wentz Jr. says, "In for a treat, Billy. I really enjoyed rewatching it." Robert Wentz Jr.'s review of The Curse of Fenric. Well, where to start? During World War II, Dr. Judson and Commander Millington are working on a trap for the Russians with Dr. Judson's machine called Ultima. Later on, Fenric, he misspells it, takes over his crippled body to order vampires, hemivores, to attack a naval base to destroy life on Earth by poisoning the water. The story has a movie feel to it. I also like State of Decay with Tom Baker. Where I would compare that story to vampire movies from Hammer Horror, this is more like the 1980s movie The Fog because it runs along the same lines. In that movie, you have Antonio Bay and pirates and a cursed community. In this one, you have Maiden's Point and Vikings and their cursed items. Love the 40s feel. We find Ace meeting her grandmother and her mother as a baby later on in the story. Fenric explains that he was the one that sent the time storm that dropped Ace off on Ice World. Ace also confronted the doctor with what was going on. The doctor explains the universe and pure evil. The doctor confronts Fenric with the chest problem as he did in the past, but Ace wrongly gives the answer to the Russian soldier who has been taken over by Fenric. Lots of great lines, including, "We play the contest again, Time Lord."
Mm-hmm.
"This is not war, this is madness." Ace sends her grandmother away to a relative, thereby repeating the cycle, but Ace didn't have a choice, or she could have wiped out her existence like Back to the Future. In the end, the world is saved, and Ace confronts her fear of water. This is part 2 of Ace's timeline story. Also, faith is looked at as well. The lack of it with the Reverend, the breaking of it with Ace, so the Hemivore could kill Fenric with gas. Also, Ace grows up and describes what time is. Great music and atmospheric feel to it all. 4 out of 5.
Really, that's why we got Mary on the show. She really does... make things interesting, and for Ghostlight, I'm always confused with it. Even now I know what it's all about, I'm still confused with it. But with this one, I've never been confused. So I thought Mary's thoughts that you know, she found it almost as confusing as Ghostlight. I thought that was really, really interesting. Right then, so thank you, Kirby. I just wanted to interject.
There's more.
I know there's more.
Even with my getting explanations, this one still confuses me, and Ghostlight is perfectly simple.
Okay, if you say so.
Billy Kirkwright says, I got to the end, great stuff. Robert Woods Jr. also has a couple of pictures from the fog. Okay. Billy Kirkwright says, oh, and by the way, while you're recording, it's still the 22nd of November in the UK, but here in Oz, it's the 23rd. Happy 57th birthday, Doctor.
Yay!
Doesn't seem 2 minutes since the 50th. Where's the time gone? Mm. You know, he's right. I remember the 50th so fondly.
Indeed. And that's more or less when Peter Capaldi was announced as the Doctor.
Yes.
Mm. Someone named Matthew Kressel.
Who's that? He sounds
great. As I'm sure someone will mention it on the show by the time Kirby reads this. Sylvester McCoy's sons played the smallest Hemovores. Pictures of them from Sophie Aldred's book, Ace, the Inside Story of the End of an Era. And I respond, they can be clearly seen in the special edition, and those pictures are in the making of on the Blu-ray. Did I mention I have the Blu-ray?
Did I mention I got the Blu-ray before you?
Matthew says, I'd forgotten they showed up in the making of. We haven't seen it since the summer when I got the Blu-ray. Robert Wiss Jr. says,
who can mention the Blu-ray the most competition? God.
Neil James.
Hey.
The Curse of Fenric. So far, season 26 has given us a fun-filled action-adventure in Battlefield and a curious dark oddity set in a creepy old house with ghost light. So what's up next? Well, obviously, it's a World War II Viking horror. The whole story has a very serious tone, and I think choosing to shoot the entire thing on location really helps to keep it feeling epic. The guest cast are a dream in the production design, and costumes look amazing. That Nazi office sends shivers down my spine. The locations are perfect, and the music is atmospheric and eerie. The Second World War setting works fantastically, and it's interesting trying to work out who the villains of the story actually are. A few highlights include the Hemovore's attack on the church, Phyllis and Jean getting their own back on Miss Hardacre, and the crippled Dr. Judson rising to his feet in what must be one of the best cliffhangers of the entire classic series. There you go, Matthew.
Yes.
The final act is fantastic as Fenric rampages through the naval base. That look of glee on his face as the poor nurse Crane is brutally murdered is so dark. The group of Wrens are also terrifying after they have been turned, and the Ancient One looks brilliant. This all plays out in the rain and mud during a thunder and lightning storm. The Ace and her mom storyline works for me and adds drama to an already stunning finale. There are a few things you could moan about if you really wanted to. Audrey has a 80s Super Ted toy, the stacked bombs look like nipples, and Ace's seduction scene is just a bit weird. But none of this is enough to stop this being my absolute highlight of the McCoy era, and I love it with a passion. So, for the third week in a row, I'm giving it 5 stars out of 5.
Yay!
Yay!
Woo!
Neil James also says, I watched the 4-part version today, but I think the special edition is the best way to watch it. It adds footage, reorders certain scenes, improves on the effects, and sorts out the weather continuity problems. Robert Wince Jr. responds, glad you enjoyed it like I did. To me, it's close to a 5, but not quite. I would have given it 3.5, but I bumped it up to a 4.
And then we won't talk about the next bit. Thank you very much, Kirby.
I will skip that one.
Thank you. There's nothing else to skip to, because we'll now move on to other feedback. We're going to start with... I've got an email. I've lost it. Here it is. From Jeff Waddle.
Ooh, we haven't heard from him in a long time.
Yeah, really? Mm. Back from the dead, huh?
Yeah.
Just to read it in Scottish.
From the dead.
Well, he's not on Facebook anymore because he can't
understand. Oh, is he not? Yeah. Still listens to the show then, which is
he's on Facebook again.
Mm. Yeah, like the last day or two, he's back on Facebook.
Is he?
Yeah.
Good.
He responded to something Laurie Nix posted.
Oh, just doesn't love us anymore.
I just think it's...
It could have been banned again, I don't know.
The irony in you lot going on and on about this is incredible when you actually listen to the email that he wrote. He says, the best story of the classic era, that is all cheers.
Yay!
That's the kind of review you like, Adam.
Jeff and I actually agree about something. That's pretty amazing.
Yes, that deserves one of these, doesn't it? Okay.
Yeah, it's all been rubbish up to this point.
Okay, right. We've also got this.
Hello, 20 Magnet Podcast. This is Ian Kirk.
Hello, Ian.
Hello, Ian.
The Curse of Fenric by Ian Briggs. Can I speak for 60 seconds about The Curse of Fenric?
No.
Without deviation, repetition...
Well, I certainly can't.
...or hesitation. That was Nicholas Parsons' catchphrase when he was a game show host. Ace is from Perivale, in the London borough of Ealing. That wuzzying woman from Ealing is a limerick unsuitable for this podcast. Millington has a plan for the booby-trapped cipher machine to be stolen and taken to Russia. This depends on the Soviets not taking it apart, which is the first thing they would do. In real life, the British kept secret that they could decode German ciphers, and so the Soviets believed it was safe to use captured German code machines to transmit their own messages. Oops, repetition of Soviets. The Nitro 9 and portable ladder get used again.
Yep.
This is the first time the Doctor visits World War II.
Yeah.
Controversially, the Soviet officer has more faith than the vicar.
Yeah.
Why doesn't the bomb under the chess table go off immediately? Because it is a TV show. Kathleen Dudman turns out to be Ace's grandmother. Ace sends her and her baby to her grandmother in Streatham. That must be her other grandmother. It is about 12 miles from Streatham to Perivale.
Ah.
Bye for now.
Very good, Ian. Thank you for nice. Correcting everybody with that one.
I'll probably go visit these places.
Pedantic by the Kirk.
But can I be pedantic about something that he said?
Yeah,
no.
Why do you ask? It's inevitable, is it not?
But he mentions that the British kept it secret from the Russians about that we were breaking the Enigma code.
Yes.
That's true, but not 100% true. The Russians had a man inside Bletchley Park named John Kingcross, who those who know who the Cambridge Five are, which is the spy ring that was recruited at Cambridge in the 1930s. Kingcross was a member of that, and during the war managed, partly because he was a bit of a genius, but also he was good at ingratiating himself with people, to have run a whole gambit around a whole bunch of British secret projects that he was able to tip the Russians off about, one of which was Bletchley Park. And the Russians actually were only using those code machines to send things that they wanted the British and the Americans to read because they knew we would be able to read it. But because Kingcross was passing messages, he actually helped turn the tide of the war on the Eastern Front during the war, particularly during something known as the Battle of Kursk, which was the largest tank battle of World War II. He actually passed through the Enigma intercepts that revealed what the German plans were, but also where the German air bases were, that allowed the Russians to effectively neutralize the Germans and turn the tide of the war. So, yeah. A little bit on the 20 megabyte World War II history podcast.
Yes, thank you very much, Matthew.
I was about to add to that.
Go on then.
Grandma-in-law worked at Bletchley, and up till the day she died, she was held by the Secrets Act, and she every now and then she'd allude to something and then be like, oh, no, can't talk about that. And they'd be like, God, please. And there's no notes, no diary, nothing. And we're just devastated that obviously because of the Secrets Act, and she was so into that. We know that she got parachuted behind enemy lines. We know that she's done stuff, but that is all. And she worked at Bletchley for ages, but that was it. And it's always been an enigma. I'd love to be able to write it for her.
An enigma?
The enigma. What a great choice of word there, Deborah.
Well, absolutely intended.
Yeah. I mean, well, it wasn't declassified until 1976 because of the 30-year rule for British secrecy. And it was only in the 90s with the breaking of the 50-year rule that they were able to reveal even more details about it. So it's something that was very, it was a very well-kept secret, except from the Russians, apparently.
Except from the Russians.
Anyway, over to Mary. Mary has some blurb from a contributor of feedback.
Yes. live from Norwich. No, hang on.
It's Norwich, by the way. It's Norwich.
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 Norwich. Oh, you don't say the W? Norwich.
No, it's Norwich.
Norwich.
All righty, thank you. Right, live from Norwich.
Yay!
No, hang on. It's the Northumbrian coast. It's the curse of Fenric. Hang on, that's Dirtledor in Dorset. Those Russians have a long walk to Northumbria from there.
Yes.
The TARDIS has arrived in the worst place they could. The brickwork with the sand piled up on it is the dangerous end of a shooting range. I did read, yes, about how the cast and crew and everybody were ordered, you know.
Oh, hang on. My speaker died. Oh, good grief. Bear with.
You.
Okay.
So much for spontaneous comedy today.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I think my speaker, might be dying. I didn't get any of Mary. She stopped.
No, we stopped just to talk to you, but yeah.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Hey, Adam.
Yes?
Adam.
Yes?
How's the spontaneous comedy coming?
I don't know why I bother. I really don't. Sorry, it suddenly went really, really quiet. Sorry. Oh, good grief.
Well, tell me when I can
tell us to hang on.
Yeah, you said hang on, so I stopped.
Oh, carry on, Mary, please. Sorry, I thought my speaker might be dying. It's only got a limited charge on it. That's why I was trying to get the show done before 2 hours.
He likes to keep us on our toes when we're reading long feedback. Always does this.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. All right, I will continue.
Thank you.
I know that camp they are filming in, that's, here, another English name you're going to correct me on, Crowborough, a god-awful place. I have stayed there many times. Nicholas Parsons as a vicar. The last time I saw him, he was on stage wearing stockings and suspenders playing the narrator in the Rocky Horror Show.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yes, he was brilliant in that.
The, in quotes, vampires had excellent makeup. The makeup people helped to explain that they sucked the blood by the suckers, not using fangs. Nice to see that Sophie got into the 1943 role by saying she wanted to wear stockings, although in the rough and tumble on the church roof, she showed the dads watching more than normal. Amazingly, I also did read that, that those weren't even her legs, that those were her double's legs that we got to see. On the roof. Amazingly, no complaints were sent into the BBC.
Carry on. Sorry, I pressed a button. Carry
you
on.
You really aren't going to let Mary finish.
Sorry, Mary. No, I was trying to close some windows down and it started playing an audio I didn't want it to play. So carry on.
Distracting yourself and listen to the feedback, honestly.
No, I've got to set up the next bit. Sorry, Mary. Carry on.
Linda and I thought it was a good story. What's not to like? There were Vikings, Marines, Navy, and also Russians. The twist with the Russian captain being one of the wolves of Fenric was good. Ace being time-stormed was explained better in Sophie's book. The stunt coordinator was very good. Tipping, I believe. Yeah. Everybody stay safe. Linda and Terry Miles.
Yeah, thank you, Linda and Terry Miles, and Mary for putting up with me. But I just thought something came to mind that would have been quite a funny thing that I could do if I was feeling a bit mean. The last few bits with you sort of saying it, I could take out all of the feedback you gave for the story and insert what you said on behalf of Linda and Terry. This bit I could put in. I thought it was a good story. And just have that.
Yeah.
And take out the what you actually said, Mary, because I've got you saying it. I'm not going to do that.
Mary, quite contrary.
Yes.
We also have feedback from Robert Haynes.
Do we?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, go on then. Do that before Deb digests the last of the next bit she's got to do.
He says, anyway, here's some feedback. Curse of Fenric is one of my favorite stories. so it sucks that I can't be on to discuss it. It's so well plotted and flows nicely. The Hemivores look great. Sophie and Sylvester are so wonderful together, and I love all the stunts they do. It was also nice, all the business with the baby and the realization how she said she loved the baby and then discovered the baby grew up to become the mother she hates. I love that kind of stuff.
Yes.
A wonderful story in which everything works in my eyes anyway. Though it is kind of sad to realize virtually everyone dies. So, what? The Doctor and Ace vanish at the end, leaving things to be discovered? Just how does that get an explanation to those who happen upon things? The only thing that does really bug me is the nipple area. Those bombs aren't very convincing. Maybe they could have painted the gaps between the bombs a matte black and lower the lighting just a bit more to disguise that they are just from a plastic mold.
Yeah.
When stories are like this, it only makes it seem more, even more of a tragedy that the show had only one more story and cancellation. I know. Oh, one more story.
All right, Kirby. Debbie.
You're there.
Are you ready?
My turn.
Yeah, ready.
I think he's ready for you now.
Oh, yes. Right. Okay. Right. You interrupted Mary three times. I'm going.
I didn't mean to. And if the speaker goes quiet, I may be interrupting you because it's running out of battery.
Cracking the Norse code, or when I say rune. Dear 20 megabiters, the curse of Fenric is, of course, a closely studied examination of faith, love, and class loyalty. The central counterpoint of Ace's love and hate for her mother lies at its centre, and the juxtaposition of a failed Christian faith and a robust faith in the Russian Revolution sets up an interesting vortex as a backdrop. The revelation that by joining forces, the pawns can win against their overlord chimes in as a workers of the world unite message. This significant reality is further juxtaposed to the games played by those that consider themselves the bigger pieces and set themselves up as more important than those they consider their pawns. The Doctor wins by understanding this and casting aside Ace's faith in him and empowering the pawns whilst it is beyond Fenric's comprehension. By adopting a baptismal parallel in the final scene, we are to understand that all the manipulations and dominations laid upon Ace's life have finally been washed away and her shackles are released. It should be noted that while some suggest that getting game show hosts and comics to appear in Doctor Who was stunt casting, in fact Nicholas Parsons does a fine acting job here as a faithless vicar, and nobody should hold it against him that his father was the doctor that delivered Margaret Thatcher into this world.
Oh, man.
That one straight, sorry. We also learn that Nurse Crane survived, but must have been affected by the Hemivores, as she later turned up at the hospital Martha worked at, being hunted by Jejune for her vampiric crimes with a special straw. All in all, The Curse of Fenric is an interesting and substantial story. Whilst it shares a common problem of the faulty and undisciplined production team at the time, it does remain coherent in the broadcast format. Ace's backstory, which has seemed a bit tenuous and convenient, becomes significantly more satisfying, and the tortured pathway from the mother she hates to the baby she loves is a successful and satisfying circle to complete confronting her with her past, present, and future. Not all of the acting is fantastic, but mostly it falls short when characters are going through something weird, so you can put it down to that. The look of the Hemivores is effective, though mobility-wise they struggle a little. Still uncomfortable occasionally, despite being a now well-defined Doctor character, McCoy's performance mostly holds together well, whilst carrying the credibility of the Doctor's past association with Fenric on his shoulders. Ace's seduction scene is not entirely successful, and is entirely cringeworthy. It is at least head and shoulders above the excruciating dialogue which is supposed to establish the teenage girl vacuous evacuees. The more crucial roles are very well played, however, and this production proved that the ambition and capacity of those making the show remains and had the potential to achieve a high-quality show if they had been given further chances. The story is about 12 minutes too short because the extended versions included uncasted material that was shot at definitely better paced and richer. Mm-hmm. Next up, Doctor Who and the management, or if cheetahs can run so well, why do they ride horses? Alan T. Butcher.
Yay.
Well done, Alan.
They're lazy.
Well done.
Lazy.
Right, I'm just going to...
Lazy.
Now, bear with, I've got to do a technical ding.
Mm-hmm. Next.
Oh, it worked. No, it didn't. Hang on, I'm doing some technical stuff.
All right.
Some technical...
Oh, it worked! Woohoo! No,
technical jerry-puggery.
Yes, and what it is, it's loading up one of the video feeds so I can actually read stuff coming through. What have we got coming here then? Robert Vince Jr. Now they drink blood or take their energy, and then taking their souls. Terry Miles, mine Führer, I can walk. Laurie Nix, Jeff the Little Dickens. Oh, Jeff that Little Dickens.
Yeah, I had to reread that a couple of times.
Alan T. Butcher, you need to worry if you agree with Jeff Waddle. And Kirsty Bissett, I don't know who she is, but she's said, but a shorter read. Oh, I see, sorry. No, I was getting all excited for something interesting to come up on the feed, and the fact that I was able to load it up and actually read some of it. Oh, that's good things, always. Managed to sort of get to, oh, there's something. Oh, hi all, Killy Burt Bright. No, I mean, it's Billy Kirk Bright. It says, hi all. Hi all, Billy.
Hi.
Hi all.
Hi all. It's off to going to watch the telly. I go in a minute. Right, so the only thing because we're running out of time, talk about sponsors, but I did get something through from Lavazzi, and they, Melinda actually posted it on the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who Podcast Facebook group, which you can join. Ouch, got an itchy back. Oh, that's it. And it is, I'll forget the thing up, where is it? Is this slick, isn't it? Oh, here it is, right, yeah. Doctor Who contest on the Lavazzi blog. So go to lavazzi.co.uk, go on to the blog, and there's a competition. Isn't there, Kirby?
I guess.
Oh, that was a very long delay. I don't know. I haven't actually looked at it yet because I got the email when I was at work. I haven't looked at it yet either.
That's why I don't know.
Oh, win an official Doctor Who scarf. Says,
what is the contest?
I'm just reading it now, Mary. Win an official Doctor Who scarf worth £69.99. It's Doctor Who's 57th anniversary on the 23rd of November. Our favourite SF show turns 57, and what better way to mark the occasion than giving away an official Doctor Who scarf worth £69.99? It was either that or Jelly Babies. You can enter 5 ways. The more options you select, the more entries you get. That means more chances to win. Those are beautiful odds, probably. And the offer is valid, get this, worldwide, and ends on the 29th of November at 11:30 p.m. UK time. So, yeah, go for it. And the good thing about that is I'm eligible to enter, so I'm going to do that and get myself a new scarf. Thank you very much. Lavazzi.co.uk. Doctor Who News. I must have a look. I know we're running a bit over, but we can't not do Doctor Who News. Did we talk about Jeffrey Palmer's passing last week?
You did when I was on.
You weren't on last week?
No, but we did the week before when I was on.
But someone else has passed away in between then and now.
It's been a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I know, but somebody else has passed away between then and now, and I can't remember who it is, and it wasn't mentioned on DoctorWhoNews.net. Oh, no. I'll never remember. There's so many people have passed away recently. Sorry?
I don't know.
You don't? Oh, we've done the VIP tour, the Doctor Who magazine presents, filming begins. In fact, there's nothing new. What's it? Oh, the Archive of Ilos? Daleks?
Yes, Dalek animation thing that's on YouTube as part of Time Lord Victorious.
Oh, I see. Data Extract turns 40. Newsletter of the Doctor Who Club of Australia. Data Extract turns 40 this month. Yeah. And Comzik Mask issue 12. The Doctor Who Appreciation Society has released issue 12 of Cosmic Mask, but it says Comzik at the top.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. So what is it? Oh, it's supposed to be Cosmic Mask. I like Comzik. Yeah. I think that's sounds like it's got a comic mismatch thingy going on there. So not a lot of Doctor Who news, to be fair. And I mean, we haven't got that long to go between the next brand new episode. There's only about 5-6 weeks to go before we see that. Next week we've got to review a story called Survival, and then that therefore brings us
mentioned this thing called whoan.co.uk?
No, I said I wasn't necessarily going to do you've mentioned it now, but I wasn't going to do the sponsors that much this week, but I had to mention Lavazzi because that was current.
So there.
Okay, then. IWHeroes.co.uk.
I do excuse him.
Yeah, really. Quite aggressive here, Kirby.
Actually, Heroes were saying, please buy stuff from them because they're finding it difficult because nobody's going in the shop because they have to do click and collect. Posting a lot of videos of boxes being opened with interesting stock in. I'm waiting for a couple of Mandalorian things to become available. One is the child with the egg canister, which is, it looks absolutely adorable, but it's quite expensive, so I'm waiting for that to come out. I know they're Funko Pops are re-releasing the 10th Doctor, which I have anyway, and I've paid about 30 quid for mine. They're really re-releasing exactly the same one for $9.99. So that's some good stuff coming out in a line of pop vinyls. So that's iwheroes.co.uk. If you're near in the UK, you can actually get your stuff shipped to you. If you are outside the UK, as of at the moment, not yet. But I'm sure that when they realise there's a possibility of sending things all around the world and making lots of money, they will sort that side of things out. But anyway,
they could send stuff to some of us Americans to review.
Yeah, but that's what I just said. They're not shipping abroad as yet.
Right, that mean on or off the island?
Obviously mainland Britain, but nothing very funny. Yes, they're shipping off the island. There wouldn't be much use having a blimmin' mailing thingy service if they didn't go off the island. But it's the international shipping that is an issue. I know Who1 do international shipping because Kirby's bought lots of stuff from them, haven't you? Yeah, I think that's a cackle of agreement, obviously. Right, so next week it's survival. Like I say, that brings us to the... Pardon? Brings us to the end of the first segment of the journey. It's only taken about 7 years, but we're there at the end of the first segment of the journey, and then there's a few little sort of things. Debbie wasn't here last week, so just we'll just recap. We'll be doing the following week Dimensions in Time, the following week after that the Doctor Who movie, the following week after that will be the Curse of Fatal Death, the following week after that will be the Shalka story, which I can never remember the title of.
The Scream of the Shalka.
So you get a load of pedants on, they all shout it all at the same time.
In harmony.
Wait a second. Dimensions of Time isn't long enough to deal with.
Yes, it is with you on, Kirby. We'd probably end up doing it 2 hours. It's a 5-minute story, which you probably stretch out for about 5 years. Yes, we'll be doing that next week.
Well, it only feels like it lasts 5 years.
I'll find some 3D glasses for it.
You don't need 3D glasses. Is everybody all right with watching that? Because I've actually got a hard copy of it somewhere. I think it's on YouTube,
or at
isn't
least it was at one point.
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
If I can't find it on YouTube, can I borrow it? I'll give you a shout.
No.
Cheers.
Yeah, I'll be looking for it. I've seen it a long time ago, but I don't.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
I'll post a link on the 20 megabyte group when I find it for everybody.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea, Matthew. I'm just refreshing the live feed so I see if anything else will come through. Nope, just Billy saying hi all. So yeah, that's
hi, Billy.
Week. Is it? Oh, Doobie Flies up. Sorry. Oh, you said Billy, didn't you?
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, that's about it.
What's this Dimensions in Time special edition someone has posted?
Yeah, I just noticed that. I'm wondering that too. I may have to watch that.
Well, I might have to watch God that. Where was that posted?
Yeah, it's 21 minutes long versus 17 minutes for
that sounds better.
Yeah,
we'll watch that one.
And here's another one, remastered 50th anniversary special.
Ooh.
Huh.
Hey.
Okay, looks like I've got several to watch.
50th anniversary special.
Yeah, there's three different versions of it for some reason.
Okay, well, that gives us something to talk about. Yeah, what's the difference?
Somebody post the longest version that's coherent and we can watch them and enjoy. That'd be great. Thank you very much.
Adam, have you seen Dimensions in Time? Did you just call it coherent?
Yeah, I said, no, that's not what I said. I said, the most coherent version.
I breast my case.
You breast your case. Anyway, right.
You guys are going to post the links, right?
Yes, please.
Yes.
We'll have a bit of fun with this.
To all of them, right?
To all of them, yes.
Now, can we just post the link to the longest one so as we can all watch the same one and then we won't Yeah, mind you, I've got it on video. I'll probably use the video, the DVD one I've got as reference. Otherwise, I'll lose the plot. But yeah, that's next week.
Plot?
No, next week is Survival. That's the week after next. And you've got to bear in mind that with all this sort of padding that's going on, there'll probably be a break for the brand new episode, New Year episode, or what we're ever going to get, and we'll probably end up doing or resuming the journey with Rose in the new year.
I thought we'd be getting a trailer for that pretty soon.
A trailer? What, for Rose? I don't know. I think that was probably a few years ago.
No, for the New Year's special.
It's supposed to drop tomorrow, I think. Ooh. Or something dropping tomorrow, sense. Apparently.
That makes sense. The perfect day to drop it.
Of course it is. So anyway, Kirsty.
Yes.
No, you are still there. That's good. You've obviously not had a chance to say much because people have been talking over you throughout the whole episode.
No, I've been fine.
Good, that's all right. That's one of the, I don't want everybody to get a chance to speak in that, you know.
Well, I knew we had to get out of here in a hurry, and some people don't make that very easy.
Caring co-presenter. You see that, everybody? Caring co-presenter. Right then, I'm going to get going because I want to watch Murder on CCTV. I want to get a bath and get a large
every
drink
Sunday.
Of water. Yeah, it's the last one, I think. Well, certainly getting towards being the last one of the series.
How do you like The Mandalorian?
Yeah, I forgot. Now, that's very good, Kirby. I wanted to talk about that very briefly. Brilliant. Still brilliant. And the other thing that's still brilliant is Star Trek Discovery, although it had a rather disappointing element to it this week. But still brilliant.
I need to watch it.
Yes, you do.
I used to
do. You like Star Trek, Kirby?
Yeah.
Yes, I do, but I haven't seen any of that.
And I'm still waiting
I saw Picard and was disappointed.
I'm still waiting for Mary to give me a heads up as to when the next series of Orville starts, because I can't wait.
Yeah, they have not been advertising it.
No,
so
they haven't.
In the past, it's always premiered like around February of each year, so... Hopefully that'll be when it happens again.
It is happening because, obviously, like I said last week, when he lost a bet, didn't he, about Biden winning the election, and he's sort of he had to jump in a swimming pool with his clothes on. I think there's something like that, which I showed a video of. But the newscast who led in the clip said that prior to the new series of Orville coming out, so it must be soon.
Yep. Early part of the year, probably.
Yes. Right then. So, that's it then. Until next time. I might have grown some of my hair back that I've lost while doing this episode. hang on. We've got Plot What Plot from Alan T. Butcher. talking about the show, not about Doctor Who. Anyway, right. Time.
Does Alan T. Butcher realize he's going to have to closely study Dimensions
yes,
in Time?
Yes, closely study Dimensions in Time. That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
He closely studies everything.
Yes. So until next time, thank you for listening, watching, taking part, and
all right.
Providing
the
us with feedback.
The three versions of Dimensions in Time are posted on the Facebook group.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Goodbye.
I've already downloaded them, too.
Goodbye,
Fancy Pants.
Bye-bye.
So long. Thanks for all the fish.
You're quite welcome.
20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast is an APV services production sponsored by whoone.co.uk and lavazzi.co.uk. We are a proud member of the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance. Doctor Who is a trademark of the BBC. No copyright infringement intended.